Chapter 11. And when, suddenly, the perpetual concession of the Santome mine was offered to him in full settlement, his alarm became extreme. He was versed in the ways of governments. Indeed, the intention of this affair, though no doubt deeply meditated in the closet, lay open on the surface of the document presented urgently for his signature. The third and most important clause stipulated that the concession holder should pay at once to the government 5 years' royalties on the estimated output of the mine. Mr. Gould, Sr., defended himself from this fatal favor with many arguments and entreaties, but without success. He knew nothing of mining. He had no means to put his concession on the European market. The mine as a working concern did not exist. The buildings had been burnt down, the mining plant had been destroyed, the mining population had disappeared from the neighborhood years and years ago, the very road had vanished under a flood of tropical vegetation as effectually as if swallowed by the sea, and the main gallery had fallen in within 100 yards from the entrance. It was no longer an abandoned mine. It was a wild, inaccessible, and rocky gorge of the Sierra, where vestiges of charred timber, some heaps of smashed bricks, and a few shapeless pieces of rusty iron, could have been found under the matted mass of thorny creepers covering the ground. Mr. Gould, Sr., did not desire the perpetual possession of that desolate locality. In fact, the mere vision of it arising before his mind in the still watches of the night had the power to exasperate him in 2 hours of hot and agitated insomnia. It so happened, however, that the finance minister of the time was a man to whom, in years gone by, Mr. Gould had, unfortunately, declined to grant some small pecuniary assistance, basing his refusal on the ground that the applicant was a notorious gambler and cheat, besides being more than half suspected of a robbery with violence on a wealthy ranchero in a remote country district, where he was actually exercising the function of a judge. Now, after reaching his exalted position, that politician had proclaimed his intention to repay evil with good to Senior Gould the poor man. He affirmed and reaffirmed this resolution in the drawing rooms of Sta. Marta, in a soft and implacable voice, and with such malicious glances that Mr. Gould's best friends advised him earnestly to attempt no bribery to get the matter dropped. It would have been useless. Indeed, it would not have been a very safe proceeding. Such was also the opinion of a stout, loud-voiced lady of French extraction, the daughter, she said, of an officer of high rank, Officier Supérieur de l'Armée, who was accommodated with lodgings within the walls of a secularized convent next door to the Ministry of Finance. That florid person, when approached on behalf of Mr. Gould in a proper manner, and with a suitable present, shook her head despondently. She was good-natured, and her despondency was genuine. She imagined she could not take money in consideration of something she could not accomplish. The friend of Mr. Gould, charged with the delicate mission, used to say afterwards that she was the only honest person closely or remotely connected with the government he had ever met. And no go, as he had said with a cavalier, husky intonation which was natural to her, and using terms of expression more suitable to a child of parents unknown than to the orphan daughter of a general officer. And no, it's no go. Pas moyen, mon garçon. Qu'est dommage, tout de même. Ah, zut. Je ne vaux pas mon monde. Je ne suis pas minister moi. Vous pouvez emporter votre petit sac. For a moment, biting her carmine lip, she deplored inwardly the tyranny of the rigid principles governing the sale of her influence in high places. Then, significantly, and with a touch of impatience, Alice, she added, comma et dit spine vader bonhomme intendus vaus? Qu'il faut avaler la pilule. After such a warning there was nothing for it, but to sign and pay. Mr. Gould had swallowed the pill, and it was as though it had been compounded of some subtle poison that acted directly on his brain. He became at once mind-ridden, and as he was well-read in light literature, it took to his mind the form of the old man of the sea fastened upon his shoulders. He also began to dream of vampires. Mr. Gould exaggerated to himself the disadvantages of his new position, because he viewed it emotionally. His position in Costaguana was no worse than before. But man is a desperately conservative creature, and the extravagant novelty of this outrage upon his purse distressed his sensibilities. Everybody around him was being robbed by the grotesque and murderous bands that played their game of governments and revolutions after the death of Guzman Bento. His experience had taught him that, however short the plunder might fall of their legitimate expectations, no gang in possession of the presidential palace would be so incompetent as to suffer itself to be baffled by the want of a pretext. The first casual colonel of the barefooted army of scarecrows that came along was able to expose with force and precision to any mere civilian his titles to a sum of $10,000. The while his hope would be immutably fixed upon a gratuity, at any rate, of no less than 1,000. Mr. Gould knew that very well, and, armed with resignation, had waited for better times. But to be robbed under the forms of legality and business was intolerable to his imagination. Mr. Gould, the father, had one fault in his sagacious and honorable character. He attached too much importance to form. It is a failing common to mankind, whose views are tinged by prejudices. There was for him in that affair a malignancy of perverted justice which, by means of a moral shock, attacked his vigorous physique. "It will end by killing me," he used to affirm many times a day. And, in fact, since that time he began to suffer from fever, from liver pains, and mostly from a worrying inability to think of anything else. The finance minister could have formed no conception of the profound subtlety of his revenge. Even Mr. Gould's letters to his 14-year-old boy Charles, then away in England for his education, came at last to talk of practically nothing but the mine. He groaned over the injustice, the persecution, the outrage of that mine. He occupied whole pages in the exposition of the fatal consequences attaching to the possession of that mine from every point of view, with every dismal inference, with words of horror at the apparently eternal character of that curse. For the concession had been granted to him, and his descendants forever. He implored his son never to return to Costaguana, never to claim any part of his inheritance there, because it was tainted by the infamous concession, never to touch it, never to approach it, to forget that America existed, and pursue a mercantile career in Europe. And each letter ended with bitter self-reproaches for having stayed too long in that cavern of thieves, intriguers, and brigands. To be told repeatedly that one's future is blighted because of the possession of a silver mine is not, at the age of 14, a matter of prime importance as to its main statement, but in its form it is calculated to excite a certain amount of wonder and attention. In course of time the boy, at first only puzzled by the angry Jeremiads, but rather sorry for his dad, began to turn the matter over in his mind in such moments as he could spare from play and study. In about a year he had evolved from the lecture of the letters a definite conviction that there was a silver mine in the Sulaco province of the Republic of Costaguana, where poor Uncle Harry had been shot by soldiers a great many years before. There was also connected closely with that mine a thing called the Iniquitous Gould Concession, apparently written on a paper which his father desired ardently to hear and fling into the faces of presidents, members of judicature, and ministers of state. And this desire persisted, though the names of these people, he noticed, seldom remained the same for a whole year together. This desire, since the thing was iniquitous, seemed quite natural to the boy, though why the affair was iniquitous he did not know. Afterwards, with advancing wisdom, he managed to clear the plain truth of the business from the fantastic intrusions of the Old Man of the Sea, vampires, and ghouls, which had lent to his father's correspondence the flavor of a gruesome Arabian Nights tale. In the end, the growing youth attained to as close an intimacy with the Santome mine as the old man who wrote these plaintive and enraged letters on the other side of the sea. He had been made several times already to pay heavy fines for neglecting to work the mine, he reported, besides other sums extracted from him on account of future royalties, on the ground that a man with such a valuable concession in his pocket could not refuse his financial assistance to the government of the Republic. The last of his fortune was passing away from him against worthless receipts, he wrote, in a rage, whilst he was being pointed out as an individual who had known how to secure enormous advantages from the necessities of his country. And the young man in Europe grew more and more interested in that thing which could provoke such a tumult of words and passion. He thought of it every day, but he thought of it without bitterness. It might have been an unfortunate affair for his poor dad, and the whole story threw a queer light upon the social and political life of Costaguana. The view he took of it was sympathetic to his father, yet calm and reflective. His personal feelings had not been outraged, and it is difficult to resent with proper and durable indignation the physical or mental anguish of another organism, even if that other organism is one's own father. By the time he was 20, Charles Gould had, in his turn, fallen under the spell of the Santome mine. But it was another form of enchantment, more suitable to his youth, into whose magic formula there entered hope, vigor, and self-confidence, instead of weary indignation and despair. Left after he was 20 to his own guidance, except for the severe injunction not to return to Costaguana, he had pursued his studies in Belgium and France with the idea of qualifying for a mining engineer. But the scientific aspect of his labors remained vague and imperfect in his mind. Mines had acquired for him a dramatic interest. He studied their peculiarities from a personal point of view too, as one would study the varied characters of men. He visited them as one goes with curiosity to call upon remarkable persons. He visited mines in Germany, in Spain, in Cornwall. Abandoned workings had for him strong fascination. Their desolation appealed to him like the sight of human misery, whose causes are varied and profound. They might have been worthless, but also they might have been misunderstood. His future wife was the first, and perhaps the only person, to detect the secret mood which governed the profoundly sensible, almost voiceless attitude of this man towards the world of material things. And at once her delight in him, lingering with half-open wings like those birds that cannot rise easily from a flat level, found a pinnacle from which to soar up into the skies. They had become acquainted in Italy, where the future Mrs. Gould was staying with an old and pale aunt who, years before, had married a middle-aged, impoverished Italian marquis. She now mourned that man, who had known how to give up his life to the independence and unity of his country, who had known how to be as enthusiastic in his generosity as the youngest of those who fell for that very cause, of which old Giorgio Viola was a drifting relic, as a broken spar is suffered to float away disregarded after a naval victory. The Marchesa led a still, whispering existence, none like in her black robes, and a white band over the forehead, in a corner of the first floor of an ancient and ruinous palace, whose big, empty halls downstairs sheltered under their painted ceilings the harvests, the fowls, and even the cattle, together with the whole family of the tenant farmer. The two young people had met in Lucca. After that meeting, Charles Gould visited no mines, though they went together in a carriage, once, to see some marble quarries, where the work resembled mining in so far that it also was the tearing of the raw material of treasure from the earth. Charles Gould did not open his heart to her in any set speeches. He simply went on acting and thinking in her sight. This is the true method of sincerity. One of his frequent remarks was, "I think sometimes that poor father takes a wrong view of the Santome business." And they discussed that opinion long and earnestly, as if they could influence a mind across half the globe. But in reality they discussed it, because the sentiment of love can enter into any subject, and live ardently in remote phrases. For this natural reason these discussions were precious to Mrs. Gould in her engaged state. Charles feared that Mr. Gould, Sr., was wasting his strength and making himself ill by his efforts to get rid of the concession. I fancy that this is not the kind of handling it requires, he mused aloud, as if to himself. And when she wondered frankly that a man of character should devote his energies to plotting and intrigues, Charles would remark, with a gentle concern that understood her wonder, "You must not forget that he was born there." She would set her quick mind to work upon that, and then make the inconsequent retort, which he accepted as perfectly sagacious, because, in fact, it was so, "Well, and you? You were born there too." He knew his answer. "That's different. I've been away 10 years. Dad never had such a long spell, and it was more than 30 years ago." She was the first person to whom he opened his lips, after receiving the news of his father's death. "It has killed him," he said. He had walked straight out of town with the news, straight out before him in the noonday sun on the white road, and his feet had brought him face to face with her in the hall of the ruined palazzo, a room magnificent and naked, with here and there a long strip of damask, black with damp and age, hanging down on a bare panel of the wall. It was furnished with exactly one gilt armchair, with a broken back, and an octagon columnar stand bearing a heavy marble vase ornamented with sculptured masks and garlands of flowers, and cracked from top to bottom. Charles Gould was moldy with the white dust of the road lying on his boots, on his shoulders, on his cap with two peaks. Water dripped from under it all over his face, and he grasped a thick oaken cudgel in his bare right hand. She went very pale under the roses of her big straw hat, gloved, swinging a clear sunshade, caught just as she was going out to meet him at the bottom of the hill, where three poplars stand near the wall of a vineyard. "It has killed him," he repeated. "He ought to have had many years yet. We are a long-lived family." She was too startled to say anything. He was contemplating with a penetrating and motionless stare the cracked marble urn, as though he had resolved to fix its shape forever in his memory. It was only when, turning suddenly to her, he blurted out twice, "I've come to you, I've come straight to you," without being able to finish his phrase, that the great pitifulness of that lonely and tormented death in Costaguana came to her with the full force of its misery. He caught hold of her hand, raised it to his lips, and at that she dropped her parasol to pat him on the cheek, murmured, "Poor boy," and began to dry her eyes under the downward curve of her hat brim, very small in her simple, white frock, almost like a lost child crying in the degraded grandeur of the noble hall, while he stood by her, again perfectly motionless in the contemplation of the marble urn. Afterwards they went out for a long walk, which was silent till he exclaimed suddenly, "Yes." But if he had only grappled with it in a proper way. And then they stopped. Everywhere there were long shadows lying on the hills, on the roads, on the enclosed fields of olive trees, the shadows of poplars, of white chestnuts, of farm buildings, of stone walls. And in mid-air the sound of a bell, thin and alert, was like the throbbing pulse of the sunset glow. Her lips were slightly parted, as though in surprise that he should not be looking at her with his usual expression. His usual expression was unconditionally approving and attentive. He was in his talks with her the most anxious and deferential of dictators, an attitude that pleased her immensely. It affirmed her power without detracting from his dignity. That slight girl, with her little feet, little hands, little face attractively overweighted by great coils of hair, with a rather large mouth. Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.